Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, a real treat. One of my all-time favorite broadcasters, Katie Couric, sits down for a lengthy sit-down about her new book, Going There, where she really goes there. It is the number one best-selling book in America for nonfiction. It just debuted on the New York Times best-selling list this week at number one. Katie opens up about a lot of different topics, including her time on Today with Matt Lauer, that controversy there, the loss of her husband, what she's learned from that, her stand-up to cancer work, her tumultuous time at CBS, her interview with Sarah Palin. We talk about the loss of her sister. We talk about young people, journalism today, interview techniques. It's a fascinating conversation with somebody who's lived an extraordinary life. And so I hope you enjoy it, this extended version of it. And I encourage you to check Katie out on tour as well. For tickets to that, you can go to Ticketmaster.com/going there. So here is Katie Couric.
Welcome back to The Issue Is. Congrats on the book, congrats on the tour, and congrats on the dance moves.
Thank you very much, Alex. I think I need to work on my dance moves. I think Leslie Jordan's got me beat, but really, thank you so much for having me, and thanks for reading the book.
Yeah, the book is fantastic. We'll talk about that in a moment, but let's start, though, with the tour. What is the show like? If I come out next week here in California, I come to the tour, what's my night like?
That's an excellent question, Alex, because it really is kind of an amalgam of a lot of things. It's a little like a one-woman show. And then there's Chloe Fineman and Melissa Villaseñor. They joined me in New York. What I wanted to do was talk a little bit about my book, but I'm not really interesting enough, Alex, to sustain 90 minutes. So I do what's kind of a mini TED Talk where I talk about sort of life lessons and sort of how I approach my career. Then I'm revisiting someone from an important issue or story I've covered during the course of my career. In Boston, I interviewed a survivor of the marathon bombing who I interviewed named Celeste Corcoran, who lost both of her legs. Lauren Manning was someone I interviewed after 9/11, who had been burned over 80% of her body. In Los Angeles, I'll be talking to Tarana Burke, who will really kind of give us an update on the Me Too movement, because I talk about that in my book. I interviewed Nicole Hannah Jones in Washington to talk about the 1619 Project and critical race theory and how it's been weaponized in many quarters. So that's one aspect of the show. Then I talk about my career a little bit more, and then I have a featured guest who I have a substantive conversation with about their life, their career, how they see the world right now. I talked to Savannah Guthrie in Philadelphia about journalism. I talked to Kara Swisher about Facebook and technology in Washington, D.C. And I talked to, as you saw, Chloe and Melissa about women in comedy. Leslie Jordan will just be a fun conversation. Jen Garner is an amazing person who does so much with Save the Children and Once Upon a Farm. And she just, I think, oozes goodness and joy. And so I'm trying to make it, it's a little bit of everything for the people who come. I hope they leave inspired and enlightened and feeling good about the world, Alex, which I think is sort of in short supply these days.
Is there any part of you, the little girl that grew up in Virginia, that sees your name in lights, that you're on tour like the Rolling Stones? Is it kind of a surreal thing?
Honestly, it's sort of embarrassing because, you know, I wanted to be in community. I wanted to be with people and to just sort of have a joyful 90-minute time period with them. So I feel honestly a little embarrassed, like, who do you think you are walking out on these stages with people in the audience? But, you know, I do feel this weird closeness. Alex, you probably do too with your audience. And I, you know, we have shared so much through the years, but with, you know, the stories I've covered, the experiences I've had, losing my husband and sister, as I write in the prologue, many people feel like they know me, and they do. They just don't know me as well as they will after reading the book, for better or for worse. And so I feel this very strong connection with with the audience that's followed me all these years.
Yeah, and you know, so let's talk about the book. I got my copy here. As I've said before, you're one of the main reasons that I got into broadcasting. So I'm a little biased. I read the whole book. I feel it's not just good, it's great. There has been so much written about the book. So much of it is wrong. There's small sentences that were taken out of context by people who clearly did not read the book. So I'm not gonna ask about RBG or Ashley Banfield or Diane Sawyer. There are like dozens of interviews where Katie talked about that. Look them up if you wanna see that. They take up about page in the book, 500 pages.
Or a line, you know, I think that actually says a lot about our modern media landscape, Alex, something that I'm sure you think about on a regular basis because it so affects you and the stories you cover. You know, I think that the tabloid press is just looking for salacious, sensational clickbait. And so if that means having to create an alternative narrative that doesn't really exist, I think it's actually a pretty sad commentary. And if people wonder why you don't trust the media, it's because of things like this. When you read the book and you see this isn't at all at the tone, the spirit, or even the content of the book, that doesn't really give you a lot of faith in the publications that you're seeing. And I think, as I said, then legitimate publications that haven't had access to the book or read it, it repeats it. And that's how things go, you know, get totally out of line with whatever it is they're covering. So it was actually a bizarre experience to see this unfolding in a very meta way, because I talk a lot about that in the book and how women are often characterized as being in this cat fight and how women are as competitive as men. And you have to be competitive to do well in the news business. And yet it's such a sexist, anachronistic trope that they fall back on.
It feels like we are living through the next chapter of the book where you would break all of this down, because it definitely felt like one of the chapters in the book, the way the book has been responded to. I do want to talk about, though, a major theme of the book, which was this battle over what to call you, which became really a metaphor for a much bigger issue. This was your first day on Today, and listen to how Katie is introduced.
This is Today with Bryant Gumbel, Catherine Couric, and Joe Garagiola.
Today, how did it sound?
Sounded good, but I still can't decide whether I'm Catherine or Katie.
Alex, re-rack it for us,
right? Catherine Couric.
So this became kind of a running theme throughout the book, right? Are you Catherine? Are you Katie? Are you serious? Are you funny? And kind of a bigger theme for, can women have it all? Can you be both?
Yeah, I think that it's very hard for sometimes an audience and the media to accept multidimensionality. I was watching The Morning Show actually yesterday, and I think that was something that Steve Carell made a comment on. That's obviously a very different situation. But, you know, I think that on the Today Show, I was expected to sort of be all things to all people. I would have to do very serious interviews. And in many ways, as you know, Alex, I'm a very serious person. I care deeply about issues, but I also had to have a lot of fun and be extremely palatable to a mass audience, which was fine because I really was very much myself. But I think for a lot of people, they are categorized. And somehow, if you're funny or friendly and outgoing, that you're perky, which I think, of course, was an adjective I got saddled with. And I think it was sort of diminishing of my abilities and pretty sexist probably too, because I don't think men are called perky, you know. And so I think it's these archetypes that we established in society, especially for women, that are very hard to break and very hard to, I think, transcend. And so I do talk a lot about that, and about sort of birth order and personality, and can you be both things, or do you have to choose one or the other? And I've always felt comfortable with both of my sides, my Catherine side and my Katie side, but I think it was hard for other people to sometimes square those two aspects of my personality.
Yeah, and as much as I've tried to be like you professionally, nobody's ever called me perky over the years. So it's a little bit.
You're too tall. Yeah. I think you're too tall, and I talk about sort of physicality. You know, right. I'm on the shorter side. I have this big, gummy, lopsided smile, and I am super outgoing and personable. I mean, that's just my personality. It always has been, but that shouldn't negate the fact that I'm also intelligent, right, and think deeply about topics and can be as tough as you can, Alex, when you're doing a big interview.
Yeah. Well, we know you can be tough. It seemed like the Today Show was sort of the Goldilocks, though, time for you, right? You got to be Catherine and Katie.
Yes.
And you got to do a lot of that alongside Matt Lauer. And the two of you were the most successful duo in the history of morning TV. Why do you think it worked so well for the two of you on camera?
You know, I think that Matt is very quick on, or was very quick on his feet when he had that job. I think we really appreciated each other's sense of humor and personalities. I really do think Matt is very, very funny and quick-witted. And I don't know why, you know, it's that intangible thing called chemistry when people sort of just are able to throw it back to each other. And for whatever reason, it just worked. And, you know, I think that we just really, he's a very funny guy, you know, and as I said, is very, very quick-witted. Sometimes it would make me mad that he was so much funnier than I was, because I try to be funny too. But I never felt competitively funny with him. I always really appreciated his sense of humor, and I think he felt the same about mine.
You know, there was something professionally that kept bringing you guys back to each other. You write that he tried to bring you back to Today when Meredith Vieira was leaving. You tried to bring him to your syndicated talk show as a co-host. You said you didn't socialize much outside of work during or after your time as co-anchors, but you did go to dinner on November 8th, 2017, and you include a text message from after that dinner. We want to put this up on the screen. Here's what you wrote. In part, thank you for being such a good friend. I treasure you. Matt wrote, we have and always will have that ease and connection. I adore you. Now, weeks after that, he was fired, accused of sexual improprieties. You say that he feels like you betrayed him. Why do you think that is?
Well, gosh, it's very complicated, Alex. And I think that, you know, I really did appreciate Matt's friendship, but it was, you know, I would say it was a contained friendship. I write about that dinner we had and feeling closer to him that night than I had in a long time. I think I always tried to keep our relationship very professional. I didn't socialize with him, as you mentioned. I thought that was a recipe for disaster. You know, some people who work together go out and spend a lot of their free time together. I wanted to keep it really limited to our time on air. That's not like we didn't say hi or talk to each other or whatever, but I likened it to Broadway actors. Once the show was over, we really went our separate ways. And so that night, for whatever reason, I think I confided in him some things that I was feeling, things that we never really talked about when we were working together. And now looking back on it, and as I write, it was clear that he was quite nervous about what was to come. And I was just pretty clueless about this other side of him. I hadn't been at NBC since 2006. I was not aware that he was involved in these relationships at work. I think he was extremely discreet, bordering on secretive. And so there was this side of Matt that I really didn't know existed. And I think what's interesting about the book, and I did a lot of original reporting, Alex, about permissive environments. You know, in the 90s and early 2000s, it was quite commonplace for people at the network, and I would say almost every network, and I don't know how it was where you worked, and you're much younger than I am, but there was a lot of inner office fraternization that between people who were married and all kinds of rumors. And, you know, honestly, that's just not part of my value system. That's just not my jam, as they say. And I would just do my work. I was very friendly with a lot of people, but I tried not to get involved in the gossip and just, you know, was busy raising two little girls. And then, of course, Jay got sick. Right. So I think when I talked to Marianne Cooper, who's a gender professor at Stanford, who I've gotten to know, and I talked to her a lot about all these things, you know, she said a permissive environment can often lead to more serious transgressions. And clearly, I think Matt's outsized power and importance in the company allowed him to be indulged and allowed him to, I think, you know, break boundaries that he shouldn't have. And I think it's very interesting how I write about it, because it's clear it took me a while to process this and understand how he abused his power, you know, in a very significant way.
Do you think he thinks that you should have been there for him more in this moment of crisis and potentially been more of a character witness for him, or, you know, that he's not Harvey Weinstein and there's shades of gray with this whole thing?
Well, I don't know if there's shades of gray. You know, as I got more and more information as time went on, I started realizing how abhorrent his behavior was. I think probably he thinks that I should have reached out to him and supported him more privately, if not publicly. But it was really hard for me to square the incoming information. And as I got more information and read more and heard more, it was really hard for me to kind of be both supportive of him and supportive of the women that he had mistreated.
Right. You say that you have no relationship now and you'll likely never speak to him again. You know, you mentioned the morning show. There's a lot of people who think that Steve Carell's character is based off of Matt and Jennifer Aniston's character is loosely based off of you. So, spoiler alert, this week, the two of them, who weren't speaking in the show, end up stuck in a room together. Then this happens.
I want to be better. I want to be a better person. Please. No, seriously, Alex. I want to be a good person.
Now, we know that that's fiction and you're living a real life, but is there part of you that wishes that that would happen in real life? Do you miss Matt?
Yeah, of course I do on some level, but I also feel that Matt has a lot of work to do on his own. You know, I think it's so interesting that everyone looks at the women who worked there or the women who sat next to them and, you know, why didn't you know this or what was going on, as if it was our responsibility to be the arbiters of these people's behavior. In fact, I say, why should the onus be on women to learn how to navigate the advances of men? Why can't the onus be on men to stop making them? Having said that, you know, I hope that he figures out why he was so reckless and callous and why he took advantage of young women in the workplace and his position. And I really, really hope that he's done some work in that area. I think he could be a very helpful avatar for this whole issue. But, you know, I think that's up to him. And, you know, it's a two-way street, Alex. He could say, you know, I've done a lot of thinking and soul searching, and I'm really, really sorry I put you in this position instead of the other way around.
Yeah, and that's kind of what Steve Carell did in that moment during the show. We are talking with Katie Couric, the author of Going There. To me, the most moving part of the book, by far, is when you write about your late husband, Jay Monahan. You talk about his being diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer, and you struggling to tell him how bad it was. And I know you feel like your experience can be a lesson for the rest of us to talk about grief in a more open way.
Yeah, you know, it was, that was the most difficult chapter to write, because, you know, I went from having this incredible, you know, healthy husband who was a full partner in every way, a co-parent to our little girls, Ellie and Carrie at the time. And suddenly, like, just in a matter of hours, everything changed. Jay went from being doubled over in pain to having a bowel resectioning and being told that he had cancer. And I think that, you know, some people have said to me, Katie, you need to let that go. You did the best you could. But I think because I always leaned on the side of hope and always tried to say, we're going to figure this out, we're going to fix this, that it didn't give us space to properly say goodbye. But I just really struggled with that. And I still struggle with that today. And I think you read that play out in the book. And I think in retrospect, if we had gotten some help, either from a social worker or a therapist or somebody to kind of, how do you navigate when your whole life just falls apart and the most important person in the world to you is diagnosed with stage 4 cancer? What do you do? How do you manage it? And, you know, I think we could have really gotten a lot of help in that department. And, you know, I talk about, and on the tour, how I wish, you know, Jay had written a letter to Ellie and Carrie or had done a video for them so they would have something. Luckily, he did a lot of legal analysis about the OJ case. So we do have him, and we have interviews that he did. But, you know, it just was very, very difficult, I think. And I felt a lot of guilt about the way I handled it. And I think something we don't talk about as a culture, you know, we don't talk about death and mortality, and it's too scary for people.
Right.
And I hope this opens up a conversation for people, so maybe if they're facing a similar situation, they can navigate it better than I did.
You know, you also lost your sister, Emily, a successful politician in Virginia, to cancer as well. And you write that you often think of, what would Jay be doing? What would Emily be doing if they were around today? What do you think that is?
Well, it's interesting because I was reading this morning that there's the first female person of color who was elected lieutenant governor in Virginia. And my sister was a real rising star in the Democratic Party of Virginia. She was extremely popular. She was a state senator. She was running for lieutenant governor with Mark Warner when she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and had to drop out of that race. And I really think that my sister would have been a national figure in politics. She appealed to both sides. I don't know if that's possible today, but she really was able to reach across the aisle. And she was such a dedicated public servant. So I think Emily would have done big things nationally, I want to believe. And meanwhile, Jay, I think, gosh, he would have been a force too. I think he would have been writing. I think he would have continued doing legal analysis. You know, he was so multi-talented, so talented. I think he had a hard time figuring out his path. He went to Naval Flight School and he worked on a dude ranch and then he went to law school. So, and he acted a little bit. He was very, very multi-talented. But I'm sure he would be doing amazing things now, because I think he was like me, and I think like you, Alex, just very curious about the world and always learning and always wanting to evolve. So I miss them both so much, and they just got ripped off, plain and simple.
Yes, they did. And you have done so much incredible work to honor them, your cancer research. You write, you hope will be the first line of your obituary. Of course, you had that famous colonoscopy, which is now studied as a medical phenomenon. You've saved so many lives, raised hundreds of millions of dollars with Stand Up to Cancer, and literally took the country
to a bold new world.
Well, I'm sure it's hard to kind of talk over that picture of my colon, isn't it?
Where no TV segment had gone before.
I know, it's save your viewers from watching that, but no, you know
important.
What? I'm so proud of that because it did result in a 20% increase of colonoscopies. And I always think behind the statistic, those are mothers and fathers and aunts and uncles and sisters and brothers who are walking around today because they got screened for colorectal cancer, which has a better than 92% cure rate if it's detected early. And that's why you have to get it before you have any symptoms. Right. And 10 years before a first line relative, you know, my daughters need to get screened at the age of 30 because Jay was diagnosed at 41. So just educating the population about that, I think, you know, was a public service that I'm super proud of. And then to go on with, you know, 9 women in all to create Stand Up to Cancer, where scientists can collaborate and move science forward in a much more expedited way has been so fulfilling for me. So it really gave me a mission. And I think as a result, that was very cathartic for me in terms of dealing with grief and the healing process. And I always tell people, Alex, that they may not have a platform like I do and or I did, but they can channel their grief into something positive. And I've seen so many people across the country do that when they lose a loved one, starting some kind of walk-a-thon or raising money, because you feel so powerless when someone you love is sick. And if you're a person who likes a real can-do person, there's nothing more frustrating. So absent of that, to be able to support cancer research and fund scientists or any kind of programs that will increase screening is just a really, I think, effective and productive way to channel your grief.
And what a great legacy for you and for Jay as well. We were talking with Katie Couric, author of Going There. The book talks about the good days of her careers and the not so good days. And many of those not so good days were at CBS when you became the first woman to solo anchor the evening news. Looking back, big picture, do you think it was a mistake to take that gig?
Say it was a mistake. I think that I wish I had done more due diligence. I wish I had really ascertained if this was something that the whole sort of the body politic at CBS was interested in, because Les Moonves basically brought me over there and it was almost as if I was starring in yet another CSI. He was not necessarily very connected to the news division. And I think that I should have, honestly, my agent should have had me meet with people to really suss out their interest and excitement in having me there. Yeah. I was brought to kind of reinvigorate the format and to change it up. And as I write, Alex, CBS is probably the most traditional old school, you know, slash old boys network at the time anyway. Right. And so I think as I describe it as being sort of the organ, the body rejecting the organ, you know, and I needed some anti-rejection drugs, but it was pretty tough. And I do think I dealt with some pretty serious sexism, both internally and externally, when I took that job.
Well, and many of the people that were really sexist to you turned out were doing sexual harassment at the time and are now fired. So that's something.
Oh, yes.
You also talk about, and this actually made me laugh out loud, when you talked about your replacement, Scott Pelley, let's put him up on the screen. You heard that he entertained guests at his house with an ascot and a smoking jacket?
Yes, that was word on the street. And Scott, I have to say, Scott is an extremely nice person and I think fine journalist, but you could not get anyone more opposite of me than Scott Pelley. His whole sort of presentation, and I tell a very funny story about him coming up to me when I was doing the evening news. He had a couple of people who had bought a behind the scenes tour for cystic fibrosis. And he is lovely, but he said, Katie, I ran into your sister-in-law, Claire, at the Tokenique Club in Darien. She is delightful. And I was like, wow, who talks like that? But anyway.
All I could imagine was him in his smoking jacket and ascot
and a brandy snifter.
Yeah, saying, good evening, I'm Scott Pelley. Welcome to my home.
I know. I just thought it was funny. And you know, some of the things I put in there, I thought were sort of cheeky and wry observations. Right. And I think I described that because, as I said, he was the polar opposite of me. And they could not have gone sort of more back to what an old school anchor man was supposed to be than Scott Pelley after someone who was, I think, quite antithetical to that whole anchory presentation.
Well, one great guy you worked with at CBS is our mutual friend, Brian Goldsmith. Let's put him up on the screen. He, of course, is one of our favorite political analysts here on The Issue Is. He was your producer on the big political interviews, none of them bigger than your interview with vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin. Here's a clip from that.
What newspapers and magazines did you regularly read before you were tapped for this to stay informed and to understand the
world? I've read most of them, again, with a great appreciation for the press, for the media.
But like what ones specifically? I'm curious that you...
All of them, any of them that have been in front of me over all these years.
You noticed that she was reading the New York Times.
That's right. And oddly enough, that's what I thought she'd say, along with maybe some other national publications and some Alaskan newspapers and news outlets. But for some reason, Governor Palin just did not want to say what she was reading. I don't know if she was just really over me at that time and didn't want to answer the question. She suggested that I meant that people in Alaska don't read, which of course I never would in a million years suggest. And that was just a walk and talk, a B-roll shot in case we needed it for people who don't work in television. Sometimes you use that to cover a voiceover and just for visual purposes. But because she was mic'd and because her answer was so strange, we decided to include it in the interview. And, you know, I'm sure she wishes she had answered that differently, but I think what happened was that answer made people wonder, gosh, is she really ready to be a heartbeat away from the presidency?
You know, when Brian was on our show with you last year, he described you this way.
I really mean this, is not just the best interviewer in broadcasting today, I really think she's the best interviewer in the history of television broadcasting.
Which is very sweet, well, and I agree with. But, you know, you wrote a book about good advice. What is your advice to the rest of us when it comes to doing good interviews?
Well, first of all, I think it's really important to be very prepared. I'm sure you've been interviewed by people who have not even thought about the questions, don't even know why they're interviewing you. Nothing is more insulting, I think, than having someone who's unprepared. Then I think you want to really come up with questions that will elicit interesting answers. No, yes or no, clearly. But also, I try to ask questions that will help us understand how people think, how sort of their critical thinking skills. I'm not necessarily with Brad Pitt. I'm not necessarily looking for his critical thinking skills, but you know, to try to ask, you know, interesting questions that aren't predictable, that will illuminate somebody, that will give them a chance to share something that they haven't shared before. And finally, I think with Governor Palin, the best advice I got was from Madeleine Albright, who said you should just let her talk. She's kind of a blank slate. Nobody knows exactly her positions on a variety of issues. And I think when you're doing an interview, the impulse is to jump in, especially if there's a lull in the action. And sometimes you just need to sit patiently and let someone talk. And I think that's what I did with Governor Palin. And that's why I think, you know, she had such a difficult time. I didn't really rescue her, even though I wanted to, because she was so clearly out of her element.
Yeah, on the preparation front, I felt very nervous about going to this interview with you, so I felt like I had to over-prepare with the preparation queen. We're talking to Katie Couric, author of Going There, whose tour is coming to California next week. Katie, to wrap things up, we like to play some games on The Issue Is, including a game called Personal Issues. This is where we put 30 seconds on the clock, do rapid-fire questions to get to know you a little bit better. All right, you ready for this?
I guess so.
Okay. What is the show that you're binge watching right now?
The Morning Show.
What's your favorite alcoholic beverage?
Spicy margarita.
Who's your favorite musical artist?
Linda Ronstadt.
What's your favorite musical?
The Music Man.
What's the best book other than your own?
I read Elizabeth Alexander's Light of the World, all about grief and losing her husband, and that really spoke to me. I love to read a lot of different books, but do I have my favorite book? That's sort of like, what's your favorite dinner? And I've gone way past the 30 seconds.
Yeah, I was going to say, the clock never seemed to matter to you before on TV.
That's so true. You can ask the people on the Today Show. I was curious for going over time.
Yeah, me too. So last game, this is kind of fun. It's called the name game. This is first thing that comes to mind. And I could have done this with people that you would dislike, but we're going to do it with people that you like instead.
Okay, thank you.
First thing that comes to mind, Ellie Monahan.
I mean, just resplendent. Look at her.
Yeah. Carrie Monahan.
Genius.
John Molnar, your husband.
Rock star and rock.
Brian Goldsmith.
Great, great friend.
And finally, Adriana Fazio.
Instrumental in making this book happen. Can I tell everyone quickly the Adriana Fazio story,
That's
Alex?
That's why I brought her up, yes.
Adriana Fazio was writing her thesis at Notre Dame on my career. So she came over, she interviewed me for her thesis, and I said, hey, you know more about me than I know about me. Would you like to come and help me write this book? I've signed a contract, I'm writing a memoir. And so after she graduated from Notre Dame, I hired her. And she is 24 years old. She is wise beyond her years. She's going to be bossing us around, Alex, in a matter of years.
Yeah, She's literally by your side at all times, right?
She really is. She's like my shadow.
And what do you love, Adriana? What do you love about Katie so much?
Well, I say all the time that I am the luckiest 24-year-old out there. And I'm also so lucky that she let me be as involved in the process as I was. And she's always eager to listen to my ideas, and she just is the absolute best.
I love that. See, there are good stories out there.
Our thanks to Katie Couric. Our thanks to you for listening. And check out Going There. You can get it bookstores everywhere, Amazon. And again, those tickets for the tour, you go to ticketmaster.com/going there. I'm Alex Michelson. Hope to connect with you in social media. Send me a message. Tell people about this podcast. And we'll see you next time for more of The Issue Is.